a musical background. Thank you very much, Doctor. It's a pleasure to be back again. I thought what I'd do today is this on? Do I need it? Oh, it is on. Okay, fine. I thought what I'd do today is very quickly trace the history of Reform Judaism in America, since Reform Judaism in its strongest form is an American institution today, uniquely American, and show you how our minds have changed, to paraphrase the series in the Christian Century magazine, how I have changed my mind. Show you how Reform Judaism has changed and grown and developed since it became a force in America. I ended last week by mentioning that in the 1820s, 30s, and 40s, a great mass of German Jewish immigrants came along with a great mass of German immigrants. And for all sense of purposes, American Judaism was German American Judaism up through the early 1870s. And the religion of most of these German American Jews was Reform Judaism, or a form of Orthodox, enlightened Orthodox Judaism. Isaac Meir Wise, whom I mentioned last week, was a great pioneer in the founding of the institutions of Reform Judaism. He came to Albany, New York in 1850, and I mentioned that he left Albany after his president hit him over the head in an altercation about Reform, and there he went to Cincinnati. He published newspapers, both in German and English, which became the national newspapers of American Jewry. And Wise had hoped to form a union of all Jewish congregations in America. Cincinnati at that time was the major city of the Midwest. Matter of fact, I tell the story, I don't know whether he started a seminary in Cincinnati, William Rainey Harper, who founded the University of Chicago and also wrote a Hebrew grammar, wanted Wise, who was his friend, to move the seminary to Chicago, and Wise, with his inimitable foresight, said, no, Chicago will never be anything. Cincinnati is the queen city of the West. It wasn't the only mistake of prognostication that he made, and he should have listened to what the ancient rabbis said when they said prophecy ceased with Malachi. In 1855, a conference was called in Cleveland, Ohio, where most of the American rabbis, and there were really only a handful of ordained rabbis in America at that time, all of them coming from Europe, met, and Wise was one of those. Even though he was a radical, a radical to the Orthodox, he was willing to accept the proposal that the Bible was of immediate divine origin and the standard of our religion, and two, that biblical law should be practiced and expounded according to the Talmud, and this was the Orthodox Jewish law. So that for the sake of unity, Wise was willing to make these concessions, although he did include these liturgical reforms in his worship. The Cleveland Conference was somewhat of a milestone, but each group had given a little, and it really didn't mean much. In 1873, Wise finally founded the Union of American Hebrew Congregations, which he had hoped would be an overall body, but it turned out would only be a body of Reform congregations. There was a banquet in Cincinnati. There are statements. This banquet was held in 1875 when he founded the Hebrew Union College. Now, you notice both of the names, Union of American Hebrew Congregations and Hebrew Union College, both tried to incorporate the idea of a united American Jewish community, and this was Wise's dream. However, at the banquet celebrating the opening of the college, to which many Orthodox rabbis attended, it turned out that whoever catered the meal gave as the first course Amontillado sherry and clams on the half shell. And all the Orthodox got up and walked out because this, of course, had broken the traditional dietary laws of no shellfish. And this was a split. It became known as the shrimp dinner because people had thought that the first course was really shrimp cocktail. But we found out that the first course was really clams, at a meeting of the American Jewish Historical Society, which I attended 3 years ago, a scholar went through the records of the Cincinnati Inquirer and found the menu, which is a great contribution to the theology of Reform Judaism, shrimp or clams. The Hebrew Union College, therefore, became a seminary for the training of liberal rabbis, also centered in Cincinnati, and the example of that was put them into 1889 in order to organize the Central Conference of American Rabbis. Not really a central conference, it was the Conference of Reform Rabbis. And that was the first president, of course, the president remained president until he passed away in either late 1899 or early 1900. But the drug division within the Reform Rabbis, had gone too far, and left the Reform Rabbis to be able to establish the remained in the Reform Judaism, why some of them compared to the Reform Theology, was willing to respectively do it at all. Others, such as David Hathorn, who I mentioned last week, were more radical, and whereas wise was able to hold control most of the organizations, the Einhorn School of more radical theology won out in terms of, for instance, our first prayer book, titled after Einhorn, the English Theological Study of the Second American Rabbi. In 1885, it was decided that it was necessary to hold a Reform Rabbinical Conference in America to agree on basic principles, and this was done. Einhorn and his radical group started it and really called it. As soon as Wise heard about it, he got no chairman. And so Wise went down in history as the chairman of the Pittsburgh Conference. Out of this conference of 1855 came the first platform of American Reform Jewry. And this was a platform of great idealists. Just to go over it very quickly, the first thing that they did when they got together was to okay Sunday services. This wasn't part of the platform, but they had the problem that Orthodox services are held at sundown every day and early in the morning, and Sabbath services are held Sabbath and all Saturday morning, and many people in America work. So many of the Reform rabbis thought of having a Sunday morning service, just as their Christian neighbors did, because it was convenient everybody was off on Sunday. So some Reform congregations did institute Sunday services. Now, of course, they didn't call them Sabbath services, they called them daily services. And when they were criticized by the Orthodox rabbis, they would say, well, look, you Orthodox have services every day, so we want to have a daily service too. We only have it on Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. So the first thing that the Pittsburgh rabbis did was to okay the concept of Sunday services. Then they broke down their platform into a number of major ideas, and they started off by saying that the God idea is the highest idea in Judaism, and that they also believe that Judaism's idea is the highest God idea, and so they set it in their Pittsburgh platform. Secondly, they rejected the idea of reward and punishment in the afterlife, bodily resurrection. And the only statement they could make was that the human soul is immortal. As a matter of fact, as we quote the doctrine of Judaism, grounding this belief on the divine nature of the human spirit, which forever finds bliss in righteousness and righteousness. They reject as ideas not rooted in Judaism, the belief in bodily resurrection and in Gehenna and Eden, hell and paradise, as abodes for everlasting punishment or reward. They had felt that these had grown up in rabbinic Judaism rather than in biblical Judaism, and therefore were rejected. The rabbis in Pittsburgh also proclaimed that they had rejected the idea of a personal Messiah in favor of a belief in the Messianic age. Now, here again is where Wise and his cohorts were very, very idealistic. They believed that since the founding of America had come, since many Jews took part in American life, that the Messianic age was right around the corner. As a matter of fact, Wise is reputed to have said that by the middle of the 20th century, Hebrew would be the spoken language of all mankind, and everyone would live in brotherhood and peace. Luckily for him, he didn't live to see of Hitler and other such things in the 20th century. But the rabbis said that the Messianic age was just about here, if not here already, and therefore there was no need for a belief in a person on their own to bring about the Messianic age. They said very definitely that a return to Palestine was not sought. Let us remember that the Orthodox Jew still has prayers in his prayer book for the return to Zion, the restoration of the temple on the mountain in Jerusalem, and the return to the sacrificial service of the priests of old. These Reform Jews, most of them coming from Germany, jokingly referred to as Germans of the Mosaic persuasion or American. The Reform rabbis of this time said that Judaism was a universal religion because the temple had been destroyed and that they no longer wanted to return as a nation to the land of Israel. And the Christians of Jews are no longer a religious community. They said that Israel still had the religion, the mission spoken about by Isaiah. Whether we'll say a Isaiah, or one of our teachers sarcastically said, Octavo Isaiah, that usually what we call the second Isaiah, both of the mission of Israel, and this idea of the people of Israel having a mission on the earth, that this concept still is true, that the truths of Judaism still needed to be brought to many of the peoples of the earth. And interestingly enough, they added a platform that Jews, Reform Jews, welcomed the aid of peoples of other faiths in doing this. In other words, that Christianity and Islam, which they mentioned by name, stood for the same major ideals that Jews did, and therefore Jews welcome the aid of all peoples in bringing these principles to the earth. They recommended that a program of social justice be instituted, but they did not spend too much time elucidating what it is. Reform Jews have always felt very much at home with the prophets, who were radicals, who were change agents, as our sociologists would call them, rather than with a lot of law and with roots of traditional halakha or law, so that proclaim the prophetic heritage. Number eight, religious practice. The rabbi said only those ceremonies which are in keeping with modern life are to be retained, and all others are entirely abolished. Remember, respect Jewish tradition, but neither the Bible nor the Talmud was finding anything inspired by God. Yeah. his people to its mission as a priest of the one God, and God would have been landed in New York. There they swamped the industries of the finished plenty of the bad and labor. Many of them did not speak English. They spoke either Russian or a jargon of German and Hebrew known as Yiddish. Some people call it the Jewish language, Yiddish. Many of them tended to congregate within their own ethnic groups, that is, their societies, or their lodgings, in their hometown groups, in the family, each side of New York, the Kiev synagogue, and a Vitov synagogue, and all the different groups sort of stuck together to transplant a new community to their own town. And this bothered the German American Jews, who were already Americanized, who already, to a great extent, were fairly affluent, who already were comfortable in the form of Judaism, who were Americans and had no trouble mixing in German American society and an American society. And along came these great waves, these unwashed masses, who also called themselves Jews, and these German American Jews were very embarrassed. Starting at this time, we get our first cases of anti-Semitism in America. A great American Jewish banker goes to a hotel in Sarasota Springs, New York, and he's told that there's no room for him to talk to Jews. And this is the first anti-Semitic incident in America. And there's much of the press and the clergy were up in arms about this. But this is the beginning of modern anti-Semitism in the United States. The German American Jews had really two reactions to it. In the first place, they simply disliked having to be associated with such unwashed, unclean, orthodox, backward masses. And on the other hand, they felt that since they were fellow Jews, they could not just leave them to suffer. So that a great chain of charitable institutions, hospitals, etc., were all set up by these German American Jews for their newly found Eastern European brethren, but God forbid that an Eastern European Jew would apply for membership in one of the Reformed temples, he would be turned down. There was a dichotomy within the American Jewish community. Many of these Eastern European Jews, having suffered persecution, did turn to Zionism and a hope that the land of Israel would be rebuilt as a Jewish land, so that those who had to flee persecution would have some place to go where they could live as Jews. And the Eastern, the German American Reformed Jews, feeling that this would be a slur on their Americanism. After all, how can we have Jews calling for the rebuilding of a homeland in Zion? Up until 1924, when the Johnson Lodge immigration bill effectively ended Jewish immigration to America, there was this dichotomy between the two communities. But gradually, the children intermarried, and it was considered for many years an intermarriage, a disgrace if the child of a German-American Jew married the child of an Eastern European-American Jew. Finally, an American Jewish community came about. The Eastern European Jews outnumbered the German American Jews. Eastern European Jews moved in great numbers into Reform Judaism, and as they did, they brought with them a love for the warmth of traditional ceremonies, some of their rituals and customs, some of the love of the Hebrew language, which they had brought with them and transmitted to their descendants. So a great change in terms of the sociology of Reform Judaism took part. Thirdly, anti-Semitism grew. We had Henry Ford writing a paper. We had Father Coughlin in the 30s. We had a whole range of anti-Semitic activities, the Klan. If it wouldn't have been for the anti-Semitic activities of the 30s, maybe Mel Kupperman wouldn't have a job today, because at this time, the great defense agencies in Jewish life, the Anti-Defamation League, the American Jewish Committee, and others became very active in fighting it. The growth of anti-Semitism from the 1920s to the 1940s, Hitler in Europe and Mussolini, and all of World War One and the training for World War II brought home to the Reformed Jews, who were still abiding by the Pittsburgh platform, in addition to this, Zionism as a popular movement rose greatly, especially after World War One, when many Jews were persecuted in their homeland, even though they were fought for their homeland. And after World War One, when Britain was given the mandate of Palestine and promised to keep the homeland, Zionism became a big political issue in American Judaism. And by the 1935, Zionism was coming at the same time as even Reform Judaism. American Reform Judaism was starting to lose conservative Judaism. People who saw that Reform Judaism was not much more than an idealistic ethical culture society in a sense, started guessing so much in 1885. So that in 1935, the Central Conference of American Landlords called upon a committee to write a new platform. It was finished in 1937, and at their meeting in Columbus, Ohio, they called upon Rabbi David Phillipson of Cincinnati, who was the only surviving rabbi who had been at the 1885 conference, a member of the first graduating class of the Hebrew Union College, and he was the one to make the motion that the Columbus platform be accepted and be approved. And it was, after, of course, much debate, by, I think, a vote of 109-1. I don't know who the one was. And the Columbus platform is what you have before you in the Guiding Principles of Reform Judaism. And it says in the preface, in view of the changes that have taken place in the modern world, which I just elucidated, and the consequent need of stating anew the teachings of Reform Judaism, the Central Conference of American Rabbis makes the following declaration of principles. It presents them not as a fixed creed, this is very important, still no creed, but as a guide for the progressive elements of Jewry. And this statement, as we have it, is the statement of Reform Judaism today, the closest we've come to a creed, to any type of creedal statement. Now, it would be impossible for me in the few minutes I have left to go through it all. I could ask you to read this on your own if you haven't already, but let's just very quickly summarize the major changes. Once again, they said that Judaism's God idea was central to the Jewish faith. And in just a few seconds, I'll talk about God idea and the statement God idea, because now one of the things that I was asked to talk about was Reform Judaism's idea of God. Now we have, within Reform Judaism, people ranging from a God is dead rabbi to the other end of the theological spectrum of Reform rabbis who have almost the Orthodox Jewish view of God. On resurrection and immortality, all that was stated was that man does possess an immortal soul. The messianic belief section was modified a little in cooperation with all peoples. Israel hopes, that is the people Israel, not the nation Israel, the people Israel, hopes to establish a messianic age of truth, justice, and peace upon earth. In other words, we still reject the belief in the coming of a personal Messiah, rather hoping that we can work for the messianic age which man himself can bring upon earth. Zionism, the big change, all men are obliged to aid, all Jews are obliged to aid in the upbuilding of the Jewish homeland in Palestine. Of course, this took until 1948 when a Jewish homeland was proclaimed. It's interesting that even though the Reform movement as a whole did not accept Zionism, some of the pioneer people in Israel, Rabbi Judah Magnus, who was the first president of the Hebrew University, were Reform rabbis. Magnus was a Reform rabbi. And Dr. Nelson Glick, the present president of the Hebrew Union College, a well-known archaeologist, has also been very important in Israel and also in Israeli government circles, although he is a United States citizen. In terms of the Jewish people, it says that Jews are bound together by their common history and religion, and even non-religious Jews remain members of the Jewish people. This, once again, is the old question which has been discussed for centuries. What is a Jew? You could discuss what is a Christian, you know, is a non-church-going, non-observant person a Christian? Okay. In terms of the mission of Israel, once again, a very ecumenical idea of mission. Israel's mission is to spread the knowledge of God and cooperate with all men in bringing about the messianic age. The social justice aspect was elucidated to a great degree. Reform rabbis had been among the pioneers in work in social justice, coming up at the same time as many of the men who proclaimed the social gospel were active, and many Reform rabbis were active in union disputes. Many of the garment workers' unions in New York were predominantly Jewish, since the workers were predominantly Jewish, and many Reform rabbis took part in these. In our guiding principles, many of the things that were laid out are no longer issues, child labor and things such as this, but it was made very clear that Reform Judaism would emphasize social justice. They also added a section, something that hadn't been bothersome in 1885, hoping for world peace. In religious practice, they asked a little more of the Jew, instead of just saying of the Reform Jew, instead of just saying that all of the old was abolished, they said that Jews are expected to participate actively in the life of the synagogue, to have those ceremonies which are meaningful from our tradition in their home, and to study Hebrew.
Mr. Bernard Edelstein is the executive director of the Jewish Federation of St. Louis. The Jewish Federation of St. Louis is one of, I'd say several, at least 150 or 200 across the nation, of larger and smaller varieties, but almost every major city has a Jewish Federation of sorts used to dispense funds and to administer and provide social planning to local Jewish agencies. Mr. Edelstein hails from Philadelphia, He found the University of Pennsylvania, where he got his Master's Social Work degree and a BA degree. He tells me he's a member of Phi Beta Kappa, which makes him my wife's fraternity brother. And Phi Gamma Mu, which is the National Social Science Honorary Society. Following the receipt of his Master's Social Work degree, he served in the Jewish Family Service of Philadelphia through 1953. And then became director of planning for the United Fund of Wilkes Barre, Pennsylvania for a 5-year period, and has been in St. Louis for almost 10 years, 8 years, or 7 years rather, as assistant director of the St. Louis Federation. And then upon the retirement of the director, he became executive director in 1965. He has taught sociology and family organization while at Wilkes College, and still finds it his place on programs at Washington University and elsewhere around the city in social work-related matters. Up to this point, we've heard from four rabbis. Mr. Edelstein has the distinction of being the only non-rabbi in the group. By nature of his position, I believe there are very few rabbis who hold position as Federation Director. There are some? None that he knows. So I give you a welcome break from the rabbinate and present you someone disciplined in another discipline and who will introduce you to an aspect of the Jewish community known to very few people outside of it, that of Jewish community organizations. Right? I think there's something that is very significant and relevant in the fact that the Jewish communities charitable and social service oriented arm is historically been a secular function. I will leave it to the rabbis to develop the thesis of its existence in the religious structure of the community, but the fact remains that there's been clearly, historically, a unique separation between the two, between the secular function, although derivative from the religious injunction, has remained a secular function free of the collaborative will, the religious activity of the community. So that what we conceive of as the Jewish community of St. Louis, and could be the Jewish community of Chicago, or East St. Louis, or any community of any size really, is being divided into a variety of functions and brought together under no single hierarchical leadership or no single overall bureaucratic structure. So we have in St. Louis, for example, a vast variety of organizations. We have essentially the religious bodies, each completely independent of one another, and independent of a national body that serve really an advisory role to them. And so you have this constellation of the religious bodies themselves. Then you have local social service organizations that are unified only in the sense they belong to a central body called the Jewish Federation. And this Jewish Federation raises money for them, distributes this money to them, and works together with them in planning changes in programs. And I'll go into that in greater detail. Now, in addition to these that have decided to join hands, at least with a parent organization, you have a number of smaller organizations in every community that decide to remain outside of any integrated whole. And you have small beneficial and social organizations, sometimes even small social service organizations. You have national bodies such as local chapters of universities, or local chapters of such like schools of religious education, all of which remain outside of a unified frame within community itself. And then finally, you have national organizations, such as the Anti-Defamation League of the Nation here, American Association of Jewish Education, etc. But a group of national organizations deriving their financial support and their leadership, their national leadership, from local communities. These belong to a federation, by and large, derive financial support from it, but operate freely outside of it. Freely in the sense that their program is rarely in close review by the local organization. Their program is national in scope, so the local organization really cannot very often look at more than just a piece of its activity as it pertains to that community. And yet there is a kind of closeness within each local community with a national organization that asks and expects it to be part of some community whole. I have suggested in these first few comments that there's a kind of organized anarchy involved. And there is. The organizations are many. Their interrelationships to one another are very delicate and poised on all kinds of personality and negotiable activities rather than fixed formal structures. All of the centralizing function of the Federation is defined clearly in bylaws that are honored only to the extent that political expertise require them to be honored. I say this to you in all candor, that no centralizing organization within a Jewish community has ever, to my knowledge, been so strong as to require and secure total compliance to fire from above. We have respected and have built our organizations along lines of autonomy, not, I think, out of any profound principle, but out of a rather historic experience, that the autonomous organization tends to provide to itself and to the community that it serves a greater kind of spontaneity and vigor than if it is a mere instrument of a much larger whole and is assigned a very clear function, which function is controlled tightly by the larger organization. So the Federation finds itself in a position where, by and large, it is concerned with the persuasive possibilities of affecting or reinforcing cooperative behavior rather than with the determination of a clear blueprint and then getting compliance to this blueprint. We draw blueprints. We have, in fact, at the present time, a very serious problem with Jewish education. And we have spent some several years now collecting data and using consultants, and the ever-present committees have proliferated around this problem. And we are about to present to the board of the Federation a proposal for doing something about Jewish education that hopefully will improve its quality. And yet this will represent much more a statement of the feasible in terms of what the concerned bodies are prepared to agree upon than it does an independently arrived at desirable method. And if this seems weak, I tell you that in practice it has worked very well. The plain fact remains that we live in the Federation with the problem of securing cooperation without sanctions. The use of dollar control, budgetary control by the Federation as a lever to ensure compliance and cooperation has been a very destructive kind of thing in those rare instances when it has been used, because it has seemed to have violated an underlying principle of free association.
And as a consequence, disputes, serious and trivial disputes, occur that are resolved without any kind of appeal to any higher court. And sometimes they linger for a long time and create operating difficulties for a long time. Most of the time they become resolved in a collaborative agreement to try to find some new common denominator. Now, let me speak a little bit more about the Federation as an instrument itself and how it works. In 1901, the Jewish Federation of St. Louis was created. It was created out of a handful of existing local organizations, each of whom were raising money and providing some kind of service, family service, recreation service, aid to refugees, etc. But all of whom were running into increasing disturbing circumstance in terms of raising this money. With six or seven or eight different organizations all competing for the same dollar and the same people who actually volunteered, they found that all of them were hurting one another. And with great reluctance, they were forced to recognize the need for some kind of agent to represent all of them in common. And concomitant with this, some kind of surrender of their own autonomy. Now, the last was painful. So when they created the Federation, they created it with a very limited function. Namely, in the course of a year, to conduct an annual campaign, the proceeds of which to be divided to the member organizations according to some prearranged formula. I suspect, although we do not have detail on it, that what was probably agreed upon was that each of the organizations sat down and looked at the amount of money it had raised independently and decided that out of the total raised by all, each organization had a certain percentage of this total, and any new money raised by the Federation would be divided on that percentage basis. Now, this seemed quite good because it would protect the individual organization from any kind of control by the central group. They were buying a sales representative. Period. The problem began to break down from the first instance because the Federated campaign became very successful and raised more money than any of them had, than they had collectively raised together. But not all of them needed the same equal share in the larger proceeds. In fact, from the very beginning, some organizations had a kind of doubtful or peripheral sense of urgency in activity, having to some extent perhaps outlived their most critical point of service, and while others were burgeoning. And so it became quickly real to each of the agencies that what was needed was something that went a step further in dealing with the money, and that is distributing it on an annual basis that was not frozen with any kind of formula. On an annual basis built on the needs of the organizations in the community at a particular time. This meant another surrender of autonomy. That was the only way in which burgeoning programs could be financed, and those that were temporarily at a plateau would not be building money that they could not use. And so this second function of the Federation, the distribution of funds, was taken on. And this proceeded now with a two-headed federation. This proceeded rather well. Money was raised, money was distributed, there was a responsiveness to changing circumstance, until the situation arose where pressure was being raised about the expansion of services into areas previously not provided, or the removal from areas in which there didn't appear to be any significant need. For example, refugee program in the early part of the 20th century started. There was an early flood that was all but shut off by the 20s. Those programs that had been built around refugee service no longer had any substantial demand to use. On the other hand, programs such as the recreational services of the community were growing in pace, and the community grew in size. And a real question occurred as to whether to change the nature of some of the activities of some of the agencies to reflect this difference, to reflect the difference in the nature of the community from heavy influx, constant heavy influx of foreign-born to what was becoming more and more native-born community. All of these things required some kind of appraisal of the quality and method of providing service. And so a planning function developed for the Federation. And this is to look into needs, met or unmet, to determine the adequacy of the programs, the means, the social, health, education needs, community, and whether or not new methods needed to be developed, whether programs had outlived their usefulness and therefore needed to be closed out, whether entering into new areas previously not considered relevant would now be important to enter. And so the social planning function of the Federation became more and more important and grew into its own golden period in the 50s. First Jewish Hospital was created out of four separate organizations. And more than being just an amalgamation, it became a very different kind of hospital, and it was teaching field, etc. Following that, we were very much concerned with the development of services to the aged. We knew that no one agency could carry the total responsibility for this, so we divided responsibilities among the whole group of these agencies in this field. The hospital took on certain medical activities. An institution for the aged changed its function from being a service to well-aged people to a service to chronically ill-aged people. The family agency tried to develop new programs to treat people in their own homes. The Jewish Employment Vocational Workshop was set up to provide a sheltered workshop for people who could not find employment under normal industrial conditions, but could work in a sheltered environment. And the Federation put together all of these into one large package and began to finance them, and began to build the kinds of facilities that were needed to provide these services. And then this went on, year after year, we entered new areas of concern and revamped the existing structures so they would reflect new concerns and new knowledge. One last case in point is that in about 1961 or two, the Federation faced the fact that there was a steadily shrinking population in the last existing orphanage in the community. This was a strange situation in the sense that what existed was a marvelous physical plant and perfectly adequate finances, and no children, or very few. An institution that was able to care for about 40 kids was now serving something like 12. It was no good for the kids, and was obviously a terribly expensive operative problem. Most important, the alternative kinds of care that could be available to these children were seen to be much better ways of caring for dependent and neglected children. But it took us 3 or 4 years to convince all the parties involved that one could tear oneself away from bricks and mortar and still not tear himself away from the concerns of people, the children in this case, and that the kids could be better served outside of the Hanson building. And so we created a new organization, a Family and Children's Agency. There was a merger of two. We lopped off the whole institutional activity. 10 years later, the buildings were sold. An entirely new entity was created. And the substitute for care children institutions in this big institution itself was replaced several years later. And this constant evolutionary change has been a thing that we have felt very dear. And therefore, we have felt it very important to maintain a fluidity in operation, both between the Federation and its members and within the members themselves. Now, one last word, and then I'd be glad to answer questions. How do these loosely related autonomous organizations do anything with one another? How, for example, does the religious community relate to those areas in which it has prime concerns, such as education, such as the development of the character building agencies in such a way as to be consistent with religious values, etc.? How do they work when there's nothing that either forces compliance or nothing that decides or distributes function between them? Because if you remember, I said that the religious bodies are completely outside of Federation and completely outside of any controlling family, even among themselves. But they do it on bases that are not always satisfactory. There were years when the Federation in this community was thought of as rather hostile to the religious bodies in the community because it failed to respond to some of the concerns, particularly the concerns around the quality of Jewish education. The Federation was underwriting, but which some of the religious bodies thought we were doing a poor job of. The situation smoldered. Sometimes it sparked up into real flames. Ultimately, it carried. Ultimately, it forced the responsiveness on the part of the Federation to look frankly and seriously and to invest of itself in these problems that concern the religious community. The other thing has occurred also. The Federation as a unifying force in the community, at least in terms of getting the widest consensus for community-wide endeavors, is very much concerned about getting support of these ideas from the religious bodies. Support from the pulpit, support from the organizational structure. This took some doing, and was negotiated bit by bit. And now we have a degree of cooperation that's much greater than it ever was. In recent years, we had a rabbi campaign chairman, who signaled high mark in the new cooperation. And then, of course, there are interesting things like the relationship of the American Jewish community to Israel. And here there's a large national organization called United Jewish Appeal that centralizes in the country all American contributed dollars to Israel, and which is a beneficiary of the Federation's Jewish community. There were long-standing battles as to whether or not the Israel program was receiving too large or too small a share of a total amount of money raised in the community. And then there were differences of opinion as to how this money should be used. Should it be invested in agricultural communities? Should it be invested in social services alone? Should it be invested in educational programs, etc.? There were sometimes striking differences. When a local institution said, that's all well and good to take care of the Israelis, but, charity begins at home, and we need a new roof, or we need 16 case workers, or something like that. And so, let's reduce the share. And of course, some organizations, such as the Superman represents, that are the national body, do very important work. Work that is not often as demonstrable as the kind of thing that happens in a local community. Well, you have so many people in an institution. If you want to, you can go down and see them being fed and cared for, and this is a big gratification. part of it through the kind of work that Anti-Defamation League does. And Anti-Defamation League and others feel and have felt that federations have been rather lethargic or frozen in their responsiveness to the special needs created by changing circumstances. And so we live in a series of tensions that never go away. They just shift from one point to another. And yet within this, you have, if not a harmony, a kind of framework that says we have an obligation to live and work with one another. And somehow we do and will. Thank you.
Well, it's ironic that an organization which prides itself on the Torah and its practical application operates in what we would describe as that evangelical, unstructured, and pre-religious what? Sure, that the greater time would be happy to answer any questions that you might have relative to.
Thank you.